My name is George Samueli. I'm a research fellow at the Global Policy Institute. I'm also author of the outstanding book on the wars in Yugoslavia and NATO's involvement in it during the 1990s. It's called Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. Excellent book, and everyone should buy it immediately on Amazon. I'm an author and a journalist of many years, and currently I'm based in Budapest, Hungary.
Well, look, before I actually wanted to speak to you about the election of Biden, or maybe it isn't, but yeah. It looks like it is. But I'd like you, first of all, to talk a bit about Yugoslavia, because obviously this is one of your main topics.
Yeah.
I mean, my understanding and my visit to Yugoslavia was quite, I always felt that this was a really good model of communism. You know, that wasn't quite, it had a lot of the benefits of communism without the disbenefits that have appeared in China and Russia. So can you just tell us what it was? Because when I look at what NATO did to Yugoslavia, it looked to me as if what was happening at the time, you know, the bombings, we could hear, this is back in 99, the American jets going over our heads in London, heading over there. And that what they were doing was trying to smash actually what was quite a successful model. What do you make of what was going on, George?
Well, what happened in Yugoslavia was what happened in many other countries. They ran up a very substantial debt during the 1970s. And then when the bill came due, then along came the banks and their representative, the International Monetary Fund, that demanded they impose the usual austerity measures. Well, that was of course went down like a bomb in Yugoslavia, and in particular some of the richest states or republics of Yugoslavia, particularly Slovenia and Croatia, really didn't want to go along with it. They didn't like the idea that they had to subsidize the rest of Yugoslavia. And then there were also the poorer regions of Yugoslavia, one of which was Kosovo, which was a so-called autonomous province of Serbia. Their problem was a different one, which was that they still had these old smokestack industries, which, of course, the IMF demanded that they be closed. So there was a lot of unhappiness within Yugoslavia, and there were moves toward secession on the part of Slovenia and Croatia. What then happened was that the NATO powers, and at the early stages it was Germany that took the lead, that they insisted that Slovenia and Croatia be allowed to secede, and without really going through any of the normal procedures of negotiating your terms of exit. It was just simply an ultimatum: on such and such a date, we will declare independence, and that's all there is to it. And when, of course, in a somewhat half-hearted, feeble way, the Federal Yugoslav Army tried to prevent the secession, NATO came in with all sorts of threats and said, well, if you try to use force to prevent the secession, we will immediately recognize the independence of Croatia and Slovenia. So really, the federal authorities in Yugoslavia were really between a rock and a hard place. If they do nothing to stop the secession, then essentially the secession has become a fait accompli. If they do try to do something to stop the secession, then of course the NATO powers, chiefly Germany, rush in with immediate recognition. And that is really what happened. But then, of course, the problem that arose first in Croatia and then in Bosnia, which followed also down the path of secession, was that there were very substantial minorities of Serbs. In Croatia, it was something like 15% of the population, and in Bosnia, it was something like a third of the population that didn't want to be part of these independent states, independent republics, because they had a very unpleasant memories of World War II. Croatia was, of course, led by the Ustasha, this fascist government. And Bosnia itself was actually annexed by this fascist state of Croatia. So the Serbs, who had, you know, these horrible memories of genocide against them in World War II, absolutely protested and said, we don't want to be part of independent Croatia and independent Bosnia. At this point, the NATO powers that had already recognized the secessionist republics basically told the Serbs, suck it up, because if you don't like it, we're going to make life extremely unpleasant for you. And this they did. They imposed sanctions after sanctions against Serbia proper and against the autonomous Serb republics within Croatia and Bosnia. The Serbs eventually managed to carve out of Bosnia a federal unit within Bosnia, so that you had the Bosnia became this kind of joint state, joint federal state. You had a Muslim, it's more a kind of confederation between the Muslim Croat Confederation in the west and a Republika Srpska, an autonomous Serb republic in the east. That was the culmination of that war. But then, I think, you know, because the NATO project of creating a unitary states of Bosnia failed, they took their rage out on Serbia proper by seizing on the issue of Kosovo and claiming that Serbia was mistreating and persecuting, and indeed in the midst of a genocide against the Kosovo Albanians. And this provided a pretext for the terrible 1999 bombing campaign, the outcome of which was the secession of Kosovo, something that specifically NATO promised that it would not do, because secession is something that's, something states don't really like, and no one in the world would have accepted NATO bombing if it was targeted towards achieving a secession of a part of a state. So NATO lied to the whole world by saying, no, we definitely do not want the secession of Kosovo. And of course, within a few years of the NATO bombing campaign, Kosovo seceded and the NATO powers rushed to recognize it. So that's a very, obviously a very abbreviated summary of a difficult and complicated conflict.
I mean, my colleague Martin Summers, he was involved there working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development in helping to get money to the Kosovo Liberation Army, which was supposed to be for aid of some sort, but it was used to buy guns, buy weapons. Martin was inadvertently working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, actually helping NATO.
Right. Well, that's it. That was the thing. I mean, the Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, was clearly being funded, trained, armed by the CIA, German intelligence, it was being used largely. I mean, it's not that that NATO really cared, very much about independence of Kosovo. They wanted to get at the leader of Serbia. They wanted Milosevic. Milosevic was really the last kind of socialist leader in Europe, somebody who had no time for NATO, somebody who had no time for the kind of neoliberal New World Order that was being organized by the United States and its NATO allies, and they wanted him out. They used the KLA, they used the sort of the issue of Kosovo to try to get him out of power. I mean, they've been explicit about it. I mean, they really made no secret of it, and many of the people who were involved in that war in 99 have admitted that their goal all along was to try to get Milosevic out. I mean, it was the first of the regime change operations. But of course, in terms of the actual conflict, the KLA proved to be a complete dud, which often happens when you basically are run by outside powers. they lost the war very quickly. I mean, the Serbs were, you know, easily defeated them. What won the war, to the extent that you can call it a victory, what won it for NATO was essentially their threat to bomb Belgrade, bomb Serbia back into the Stone Age. And they were going to do it because, if you remember, the bombing campaign was going on week after week after week, and Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, had promised, oh, that Serbia would cave within 72 hours. It would only go on for a few days. And so as the bombing went on and the Serbs under Milosevic refused to cave, there was a certain amount of panic that was setting in Washington and in London. What is going to happen? How are we going to deal with this? And there were already protests being mounted in the streets of Europe, particularly Europe in London, but also in Germany. They were getting fed up with this. I mean, you know, however bad the Serbs are supposed to be, of course, I don't think the Serbs were bad, but at least most people bought into the media claptrap about the Serbs. But however bad they are, you can't justify actually bombing a small country week after week after week. And so really, the only thing NATO could do is, I mean, they'd run out of military or strategic targets to bomb. It was really just to go for civilian bombing, basically just level the country. And this was the threat that they made to Milosevic. They said, we're going to do this. We're going to just destroy the entire country. I don't know whether they would have actually gone ahead with that, but you can understand why, you know, if you're the president of Serbia, you might take the decision that I can't take the risk of having my entire country, you know, the capital of my country, just leveled by these NATO barbarians. And so Milosevic kind of eventually gave in. But on the sort of the key issues on which NATO had insisted, in fact, Milosevic hadn't given in. He hadn't given in on NATO occupying force within Serbia, NATO occupying force in Kosovo, because in fact NATO had to go to the UN Security Council and had to agree to a United Nations force within Kosovo. So NATO was just planning. Well, Madeleine Albright of the Clinton administration just simply wanted a NATO force up right in there in Kosovo. That's it. Just NATO, nothing else. But, you know, they actually had to go to the UN Security Council and get a UN force to go into Kosovo. And so you know, Milosevic achieved some things, I mean, by holding out for during this bombing. But, of course, you know, NATO, of course, broke its word because, as I say, they had promised that secession was off the table. No, we're not going to stand by and allow Kosovo to secede. But of course, they did. That's par for the course for NATO.
Yeah. What about Milosevic, though? Because there's quite a lot of, in fact, I've interviewed a couple of people over the years that have said that they believe that the evidence is very strong, that he was actually poisoned at the International Criminal Court because he was starting to do reasonably well in his case. Right. And then he dropped dead in his cell.
Well, it's a very, you know, who knows, because, you know, they rushed the autopsy and then they rushed to bury him. On the face of it, it was very suspicious. But if you look back on what happened during the last 2 weeks of his life, he had applied to go to Russia for treatment for his heart condition. The tribunal had rejected his request, but no particularly good reason, because they said, "Oh, well, we have no faith that he will actually come back," even though the Russian government had guaranteed that they would return him. But nonetheless, they said no. So this was about 2 weeks before he actually died. So they denied him the medical treatment. But then, what was very interesting is that there was they had a blood test that was done on him, and then at the tribunal, and the tribunal said, "Oh, we found this thing called rifampicin in your blood." And now rifampicin is a kind of an anti-leprosy drug, and so this was, you know, Milosevic then, you know, got very anxious, wrote to the Russian foreign minister saying, "Hey, look, I think they're trying to kill me." And then, of course, he died very soon after that. Now, this is all very embarrassing for the tribunal. So then they came up with a story. Well, yes, yes, we found the rifampicin in his blood, but he was doing it himself. He was administering this rifampicin to himself in order to elevate his blood pressure, in order that we would agree to his being sent to Russia for treatment for his heart condition. Of course, there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he was administering rifampicin himself. I mean, where would he get the rifampicin? It's a rare drug. They had no evidence, but they threw out this accusation because they had no choice. I mean, they're the ones who found the rifampicin. He's the one who reported it to the Russian Foreign Ministry. So then they had to say, oh, yeah, you did it yourself. But of course, when they did the autopsy after his death, then they said, oh, no, there is no rifampicin in his blood. It was a very, very strange event. And of course, you know, as always happens with the tribunal, the ICTY, it investigated itself. No one outside of the ICTY investigated what went on there, because the ICTY is a creation of the United Nations. It has diplomatic immunity, and it's basically just a law unto itself. And so, of course, when it wrote its report about Milosevic's death, they said, oh, no, it's all his fault. You know, we provided him with the best possible medical care, and he kind of did it all to himself. So we're good to go. We didn't do anything wrong.
So Milosevic got himself a chapter in the Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, you were talking about what happened in Yugoslavia. You're implying really that it wasn't a successful economic model, and that might mean that, you know, it might have been or might not have been a successful social model. But I quite like this idea of it being, you know, not as hardcore as Soviet communism, right, and yet having a lot of socialist aspects to it, and really being a kind of model. So anyway, what I really want to hear in a nutshell from you is, was it potentially a successful model, you know, the Yugoslav constitution under Tito?
I think it was a successful model. I thought that it precisely because it wasn't really socialism of the kind of the Stalinist state model type, or capitalism, or it's not even the sort of the social democracy of the sort of West German as it was then type. It was something different. It worked until, of course, they started doing what was fatal, and the communist states really made that fatal mistake of borrowing huge amounts of money from the West. Once you go down that path, I mean, and you know, and this was clearly planned. I mean, the Western governments were encouraging the bankers to lend the money because they knew that, you know, at some point the bills are going to come due, and these countries will not be able to pay these bills, and then essentially they will have to come to us, and we're going to reorganize their states and get rid of the remnants of socialism. So I think it was a potentially successful model, but like Poland and like a number of countries in Latin America, they made the fatal bargain of running up a huge debt, and then, you know, you essentially fall into the into the hands of the jackals of the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah. Well, also, I mean, obviously now we've got this sort of term Balkanization. Do you think it's fair? I mean, a lot of people say that there are attempts to do something similar in the Middle East, to break up boundaries. Obviously, the British and the French did it with the same sort of thing with the Sykes-Picot Agreement back in the First World War, which was secret until the Russian Revolution. Yes. But, you know, Balkanizing the Middle East, do you think someone somewhere in the deep state is looking and thinking, actually, we want to do a kind of similar thing that we did in Yugoslavia to the Middle East? Is there any comparison?
Yeah, absolutely. And the one who came up with this Balkanization, particularly of Iraq, was, of course, the current alleged president-elect, Joe Biden. He actually was the one who was advocating breaking Iraq up into three states. And that's absolutely that's what they want. That's what they would like to do to Iran, and, you know, break it up into these individual kind of national republics. You know, you have a kind of Azeri part of Iran, and you have the various other parts of the Iran. So you have these essentially the kind of the state that had once existed, which was a formidable military power, a formidable regional power, will cease to exist. And therefore, that's why, you know, how do you go about this? Well, the way you go about this is by fostering religious separatism, by fostering national separatism, and then it becomes very easy. And I think absolutely that's the Western plan. And
so, I mean, is the tactic then is to fund these various movements, maybe through funding NGOs and things like that, yes, to fund absolutely. Separatist movements?
Absolutely, that's what you do, and that's what they try to do. With a certain amount of success in the former Soviet Union, I mean, you fund these national separatist movements. You suddenly, you know, you want to foster separate languages. You want to foster separate religious identities. And so the more they become aware of their own separateness, the more likely it is that there's going to be conflict, obviously, and you know, separatism. And then it becomes a pain in the neck for the rival power, which was Russia. And it was quite successful. I mean, what they did in the Caucasus in Russia during the 1990s was quite successful. I mean, it drained Russia. The war in Chechnya and Dagestan absolutely drained Russia for about 10 years. So there's always the danger that once Putin is gone, and he's replaced by some leader, some Yeltsin-like leader, or Yeltsin-Gorbachev-like leader who wants to make nice with the West, then we're going to go back to the sort of the 1990s and again some kind of Islamic separatist movements being fostered by the West in the Caucasus.
What's the purpose, though? What do you think is the purpose of balkanizing the Middle East? How does it work? What's the end result, the idea of the end result?
To destroy any of the, I think, the secular states of the Middle East, which could in any way provide kind of alternative models to the neoliberalism. To destroy any regional powers, so that the only power that would count would be the United States with its allies, the Saudi Arabia and the various Gulf states, and of course to eliminate from the scene any rival to Israel's supremacy. So how do you do that? Well, you do it by breaking states up. I mean, it's very interesting that the supposed global war on terror, which states were targeted? Well, Iraq, Syria, Libya, all three of which were actually extremely hostile to Islamism, to Islamic terrorism, and were actually secular states that had little time for any kind of radical Islam. But they were the ones targeted. And who was the great U.S. ally in this global war on terror? Saudi Arabia, which, of course, is the fount of all Islamic terrorism in the world. So, you know, that's really the goal. You break up those states that were actually the enemy of an enemy of kind of separatism. You know, in other words, they were serious states, serious economic models, and emerging regional powers.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it, that we here in the United Kingdom, we're also being subjected to this, where we've got what Tony Blair started up, the Scottish Assembly and the Welsh Assembly, right, where they're now called their own parliaments. They've got quite a lot of independent powers, and they're both very, very hostile to Westminster. Yes. Interestingly, much more tough on the COVID measures, locking their populations down, right, in Scotland and in Wales, right, much more so than in England. Right. I say that thankfully, because I'm speaking to you from Gloucestershire in England. Maybe we're having a bit of a flavour of this balkanisation in the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. Yeah, the model is the same. Exactly. You know, you kind of create these separatism. But these separatist states are not exactly the founts of tolerance and liberalism. They're actually extremely repressive and actually quite rather nasty. And so just like, oh, great, let's break up Russia. But what states are you going to create in its place? You're going to have these really horrible places like Chechnya and Dagestan, ruled by the worst of people in the world, kind of gangsters, terrorists, and fanatics.
In Spain, in Catalonia, has been very much crushed, hasn't it?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's right. So that's why, you know, I'm generally against breaking states up. I think that's I think it's a terrible idea, because it's just, you know, you're just creating problems and crises for future generations. Because
what about Brexit? You know, are we a secessionist state in the European Union?
So, because I don't think the EU was never really a state. I think the EU was I don't know what we would call it. One could say it's an association. It's an association of powers.
Well, yeah, but Ursula von der Leyen, I think, would say different.
Well, I'm sure she would, but I think, you know, I don't think it's the same thing. I mean, you have to, you know, like the United Kingdom, which has been around, you know, this 300 years. It's not really the same thing. So I'd say that the EU was a regional association of countries. it really wasn't a you couldn't really call it a a single unitary state. No, I mean, or even a political federation, or even a confederation. I think I'd say it was an association to advance certain common interests.
But you're saying almost as if it's in the past tense there.
No, I don't think it is in the past tense, because I think, but as far as Great Britain is concerned, yeah, I think that's in the past tense. I think that most of the other members of the EU kind of like the benefits that they get from it. That doesn't mean that they want to, they want more centralization, they want more diktats from Brussels, but they get benefits out of it. I mean, look at something like Hungary or Poland, who are sort of the bad boys of the EU. You know, they see the distinct advantages from being part of the EU, even though they ignore all the aspects of the EU that they don't like. So it's kind of socially liberal policies with policies on immigration. They just ignore them. I mean, they just don't implement them. I mean, Merkel says, no, you've got to take some immigrants. And Orban says, no, I'm not going to take anyone. I mean, that's it, zero, no one. And Poland has the same attitude as does the Czech Republic and Slovakia. They just say, no, we're not going to go along with it. So that just shows that it's not really any kind of a unitary state. I mean, you can just ignore
it. It may be that, you know, we wouldn't have got a vote for Brexit if the Westminster government had actually stood up a bit more to Brussels. But look, my main subject this week is got to be Biden. I suppose the obvious question is, you know, what's going to be the difference? Whether or not Trump succeeds in these legal challenges, obviously, you know, that we have to keep an eye on that. And everybody knows about the problems with electronic voting, particularly in the US elections, even though the Americans love to point the finger at places like Belarus and Venezuela and say, oh, these elections are fixed. You know, you've got electronic voting machines where we know anybody with a brain cell knows or that you can use electronic voting in order to, you know, quite subtly and cleverly swap thousands of votes from one candidate to another. So, I mean, I've always been an advocate for absolutely never using electronic voting unless you can have an actual electronic digital paper trail from the voter to the final result, so you can trace every single vote backwards and forwards as much as you want, which they don't do in these US elections. But anyway, assuming that Biden does take over, as it looks now like he will, what do you think is going to be the main difference for us, particularly here in Europe?
Well, I think that the Trump years, I mean, as far as the Europeans are concerned, you know, they didn't like Trump because he was a disturber of the sort of the cozy arrangement that they had for decades. But I think, you know, they weren't bad years for Europe. I mean, because basically Trump just allowed the Europeans to do what they wanted to do, you know, pursue their own interests while America pursued its interests. With Biden, I think he's going to try to re-energize NATO, which means he's going to try and cajole America's NATO partners into joining these various NATO projects. I mean, it's now looking like the Republicans will control the Senate. They will continue to control the Senate. I mean, they now have 50 votes. They only need to win one of the two races in Georgia in January. They should easily be able to do that. Which means Republicans retain control of the Senate. The Democrats' majority in the House is much diminished. Essentially, any domestic agenda that Biden may have is dead on arrival. He's not going to be able to pass any domestic legislation, which means what happens in those circumstances, he will become the foreign policy president. And that was always likely because foreign policy was always kind of his interest. And what's he going to do with foreign policy? Well, he will make life very difficult for Russia, because the Democrats are absolutely like they're just like mad dogs when it gets to the subject of Russia. They're still convinced that the 2016 election was stolen from them by the Kremlin. And that's where Biden will focus, which means that he's going to revive the war in Syria, and thus, you know, again, helping the sort of the jihadis in Syria. He will probably get himself involved in the Caucasus, although now that there's been this peace signed between Armenia and Azerbaijan, that may be more difficult, but not impossible, because it doesn't sound like anybody is terribly happy. Neither Armenia nor Azerbaijan is terribly happy with this peace agreement. You could easily see the United States getting involved there. And Ukraine is his is Biden's baby. It was the Obama administration that engineered that coup in 2014. Biden was the point man on Ukraine. It was Biden's son that made millions through this coup in Ukraine. He will, without question, get himself involved in Ukraine. Probably again, he will try to revive some of the sort of the wars in the Caucasus and Chechnya and so on. I think that that's going to be the focus of the Biden administration. And so the Europeans, who are now rejoicing like Boris Johnson, that, oh, now we've got someone talking our language, you know, talking about climate change and democracy and human rights. I think they're going to soon be regretting this, you know, because I think it's going to be a very dangerous state of affairs. Because Russia may itself be undergoing a transition. You know, they may be moving towards a new leadership in the next year or two, which means that there could be quite an unstable situation. And if these nutcases, who I think are going to come to power with Biden, Michel Flournoy, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Nicholas Burns, and Tony Blinken. These people, these are absolute, you know, neocons through and through. You have these people in power running their anti-Russian foreign policy. And if there is instability in Russia, then I think it could well be just an explosive mixture.
Okay, so what about the biggest story of 2020? Some would say the century, which is the advent of COVID-19. Right. There is, you know, to my mind, an unprecedented bias I've seen anyway in the press coverage, certainly here in the UK, really shutting out a lot of the doctors who are critical of the government policy. The criticisms levelled at them are pretty much consistent. One is that the actual death rates from this COVID-19 virus are roughly around the same as a bad flu year, and yet we don't obviously have all these measures for a bad flu. And secondly, that the testing that's being done using this PCR test across Britain now have been ramped up is delivering a small proportion of false positives, but this is coming up as a very large number of infections, even though people are asymptomatic. Basically because so many people are being tested who don't have symptoms, you know, you've got a small number of false positives that starts to come up and up and up as more and more people get tested. So, you know, there is also all this stuff in the background, Big Pharma and the Gates lobby, the vaccine lobby. What do you make of it all, George? Because, you know, I'm interested to hear, first of all, what you make of the bigger picture, but then, you know, how things are going over in Hungary.
Right. Well, I all of the points you've just made, I tend to concur with. You know, it is very much like a bad flu. And there have been bad flus in the past. I mean, we've had Asian flu, we've had the Hong Kong flu, and, you know, people died during those, and people died in great numbers during those flus. And, of course, most of the people who died were the elderly. I mean, you know, you have to think in terms of, you know, it sounds heartless to say, but everybody dies of something. I mean, you know, you die of cancer, you die of heart disease, you die of diabetes, you die of influenza, and elderly people have to die of something. And that's what's happening. So when they say, oh, look at how many people have died, and you say, okay, well, what's the median age of the people who have died? Well, you say it's 82. Well, yeah, I mean, it's generally the median age when people die. I mean, people do die. I mean, there's nothing, you know, you can do about it. It's part of a human condition. It's I mean, if this was a case like the bubonic plague, where young people were being hit by this plague and they were dropping dead, then, you know, it might be justifiable to take these extraordinary measures. But when you're looking at it and say, yes, you know, this is elderly people who are obviously frail and they're vulnerable, then clearly, you know, they will be vulnerable to a virus. But how do you justify bringing entire economies to a standstill? How do you justify imposing this shocking social controls on people? You know, they're prohibited from seeing their families. You know, and so elderly people, you know, it's hard enough to be old at the best of times, but you're not allowed now to see your family members. It's, you know, one of the few pleasures you have left in life. And then how do you justify not providing proper medical care for people who have other illnesses, you know, like cancer or heart disease or kidney disease, whatever? It's just an extraordinary step. I mean, it's baffled. I mean, I'm sure historians will be, you know, scratching their heads in decades to come to explain why this response to this virus was so different from the response to any previous virus. You know, it's like viruses have been around as long as humanity has, but no one has thought that the way to deal with a virus is to impose a quarantine on healthy people. I mean, it makes so little sense. And to drive businesses to bankruptcy, I mean, how does that help anybody? How does it help societies moving forward when you have, you know, essentially restaurants shuttered, hairdressers shuttered, gymnasiums shuttered? It's an extraordinary thing. And you know, the conspiracy-minded people, and I'm not necessarily one of them, you know, think, well, there's obviously some economic plan underlying it. I'm not saying I subscribe to it, but, you know, you do wonder, well, who's going to do well out of this? Well, obviously big tech. The internet giants are doing extremely well out of this because now everyone becomes wedded to their computers. The big banks are extremely enthusiastic about this because now all economic transactions are now go through banks. You know, the cash economy is just simply wiped out. So finance is doing very well out of it. Who's not doing well out of it? Of course, Amazon, you know, the whole, you know, this online retail does well out of it. Who's not doing well out of it? Well, you know, ordinary people who are just trying to run small family businesses. They're just been getting wiped out.
Well, Klaus Schwab and Prince Charles have got together, had a little bit of a love-in, and decided that they're going to do something at the World Economic Forum called the Great Reset next year. As if they were thinking about doing this anyway. But this virus has been a fantastic opportunity from their point of view to advance their plans and to make them more popular amongst people. Also, saying that we need kind of a new economic system as these lockdowns are destroying the economy. But one of the fascinating things about the World Economic Forum is last September they did a partnership agreement with the United Nations, The UN, of course, being a kind of sacrosanct organization put together right. after World War II in order to try and keep the peace and be a good place for people to meet from all around the world, yes. peoples to meet. The only thing is that the partnership agreement, if you look at it, it does look as if, well, basically the UN is saying, well, we're getting less and less money in from all the member states, so we're really desperate for money. And Klaus and the Davos people have said, well, hey, that's funny. We've got loads of spare cash. We can help fund you. So, you know, some people might say that this deal in September last year between the World Economic Forum and the United Nations is more like a kind of hostile takeover rather than a kind of merger or partnership agreement. But anyway, so they certainly seem to be on the up for the last, well, it's nearly a year that they've been working very, very closely together, the World Economic Forum and the UN. So what do you think that means, that partnership for the world, George?
Well, I mean, the what it means is power, economic, financial power becomes concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. And again, it is a transfer of wealth, a massive transfer of wealth from those below to those above. I mean, it was already bad enough before, but now it's, you know, it's grown exponentially because, you know, who are the people who are hit by this? I mean, if you have a lockdown, I mean, it's not, you know, people, you know, working in banks who are hit by it. It's not even people working in the media. They're all right. They can sit at home, you know, typing on their computers. It's those who are trying to provide a service, the small businesses, you know, restaurant owners. And so they're the ones that are sort of being wiped out, or, you know, people, you know, running a hardware store.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to get to is how comfortable are you the idea of the World Economic Forum, the Davos people, sitting next to the UN and saying, well, actually, we think that the UN should be doing this. And because, you know, certainly the World Economic Forum over the years has been basically a businessman's club. They think in terms of, I'm doing this for my own private profit. I'm certainly not sharing any information with journalists that I don't want to. It's basically very, very secret the way businesses operate. You know, they've got their intellectual property and they're holding onto it and they're putting a firewall around it. That doesn't seem to me necessarily to fit very well with the ethos of the United Nations, who have all these international bodies like UNICEF and, most importantly, of course, at the moment, the World Health Organization too.
Right. No, that's a very good point. It's that, yeah, that it gives power to these very people. I mean, that's, you know, suddenly UNICEF, World Health Organization, suddenly come under the control of people who are fabulously wealthy. I mean, you know, you're talking about people, you know, $100 billion. So that they get, you know, that have now enormous power. Once they can run all of these United Nations programs, so they can sort of essentially run, you know, countries all around the world. It's actually, you know, quite a frightening, a shocking development.
Yeah, I can remember David Rockefeller, when he was still alive, did a talk in Oxford, which Noam Chomsky was there as well, and he wrote it up. He said something along the lines of, something needs to take government's place and business seems best place to do it. But, I mean, I wonder what kind of world it will be if we've got business actually in these seats of government, because I don't know if they've really got the public service ethos, George.
No, I really don't think that at all. Businessmen have their own peculiar agendas. Often, they're profound believers in eugenics. I mean, that, you know, if there's one thing that is consistent among billionaires through the ages, they all believe in eugenics, in strong birth control, and, you know, keeping the poor down to the maximum extent possible. And then they have their own. I mean, look at the George Soros' agenda. Look at the agenda of Bloomberg. And then, you know, they can drop a billion without, you know, losing, you know, a minute of sleep. That has huge impact. I mean, just even, you know, if you look at it, just the presidential race, what Bloomberg did. I mean, you know, Bloomberg had an enormous impact on the election, even though he didn't get any votes at all. But he could just affect that election, and that's in the United States, a wealthy country, by dropping a billion. I mean, that's it. And then you can drop another billion. So can you imagine what the effect that they can have in poorer parts of the world? And what a billion here and a billion there can do in poorer parts of the world? It really is quite scary.
Okay, well, George, look, you and I have known the World Economic Forum for a while. What do you make of this Great Reset? Where will we be in a year's time? Do you think we'll have a new sort of something where we'll have replaced the IMF, the World Bank, the BIS, these big institutions?
Well, no. I mean, I think they have always served the rich. I mean, the IMF and the BIS, I mean, that's all they've done. I mean, the IMF was just simply a bill collector for the big banks. I mean, it wasn't in any sense an institution that that did anything for the public good. It did nothing for improving the lives of people or, you know, achieving economic equality or whatever. It was always basically a bill collector for the banks. And therefore, and in the spirit of collecting for the banks, they would force countries to undertake economic restructuring that obviously favored the private corporations and didn't favor anything that was collectivist. So I think they will survive, but I think that they will be working alongside these billionaires who all have their agenda. I mean, you know, what is Bill Gates's agenda? I mean, you know, we can take it that he doesn't care very much about the suffering of humanity. He clearly again is embarked on what is eugenics or whatever. He has an agenda. So once the United Nations gets involved with these people, then I think it's I think it's a really terrible situation.
When you say, okay. George, can I ask you about Hong Kong? Because we've just had the resignation of the pro-democracy party in Hong Kong, saying that they're not going to allow the Chinese government to cherry pick, arrest various pro-democracy members of the assembly there, the legislators. So they've all said, basically, if you decided that you're going to arrest elected representatives of the Hong Kong people for their views on having a different way in Hong Kong to the rest of China, then the rest of us are all leaving, and we've had enough of politics. We think that's the end of politics in Hong Kong. It's obviously quite an important pressure point between East and West there.
Yes. My feeling on Hong Kong has always been that there really is nothing very much that the West can do about it, although the West should do about it. I mean, this is it's an integral part of China. China guards its sovereignty jealously, and any attempt to interfere there and try to insist, insist on Hong Kong autonomy against Beijing, I think it's just entirely self-defeating. There are grounds on which you can take China on. I mean, I think there are perfectly legitimate reasons to confront China. I mean, on issues of trade, on issues of currency. I think on the Wuhan virus, I think there's a lot of grounds to challenge China on the way it's handled that. Hong Kong is not one of them. I think anything that takes place within China, that China regards as its own internal sovereign matter, you're going to pick a losing argument. And I just don't think there's any point to doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are quite a few journalists in Hong Kong who would disagree with you on that. They are seeing themselves as a kind of last bastion of free speech there. Right. And for example, reporting, as we reported last week, on the attack by the triads on the pro-democracy demonstrators as they're getting off the train in July last year, with iron bars, and right. then Julius Ho, who's one of the pro-Beijing legislators, shaking the triad's hands afterwards, meetings between the police and the triads, and also the tracing back of the vehicles they were using, the triads were using. I mean, it seems pretty obvious what was going on there. You had a Beijing Chinese Communist Party, Triad, police, collusion to hospitalise something like 50 demonstrators, men, women and children who were coming off the... you know, this is one of the reasons, I think, that the journalists want to keep going, because they can see that there is an extremely brutal side to the Chinese government that is now actually taking out all kind of dissent, not just you know, people speaking out for democracy, but also basic journalists just doing their job there.
Well, I agree with all of that, and there's no question that the Chinese government is an extremely brutal and nasty. But on the other hand, you kind of have to accept the sovereign rights of states. I mean, it's you know, part of international law, you know, and it's very painful, very unpleasant. If you want to take on the Chinese, then I think you take on the Chinese on those issues in which their policies affect us, you know, affect the rest of the world, not on issues that in internal Chinese matters, as I said.
I mean, certainly people who live in Hong Kong see it as a bit of a David and Goliath thing, but maybe this time you're saying that Goliath's going to win.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no question. I mean, if it's an internal matter, the Chinese government is a very brutal, nasty, tyrannical government. I mean, there's no disputing about that. But you know, they consider Hong Kong as an internal matter, and it's not an argument that we in the West are going to win. I mean, if you pick a fight, make sure you pick a fight that you can win. I mean, Hong Kong's not a fight that we can win.
George, how do listeners follow your work online or elsewhere?
Well, I think the best way of doing it is you go to Twitter, which is, and you have my name on Twitter is just as one word, George Samueli. So it's
you better spell your surname, George.
Right, exactly. So it's G-E-O-R-G, George, obviously. And then my surname is S as in sugar, Z, A, M as in mother, U-E-L-Y. So you can follow me on Twitter. I also write regularly for RT, which used to be at Russia Today, but you can read my articles there.
George Samueli, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.